Welcome to Let's Talk Land, a weekly land education talk show devoted to learning about land and farms, buying and selling, and ownership, especially for real estate agents and realtors. Learn from the expert, free land education. Hi, my name's Lou Jewell. I'm an accredited land consultant, broker owner of United Country Real Estate, Land Pro, along with my co-host Teresa Martin. Buying and selling homes, land and farms in Western Piedmont, North Carolina, or Southern Virginia, just give us a shout. We'll help you out. Our office is at 3349 Cook School Road in Pilot Mountain, North Carolina, on Highway 52, exit 136, across from Foothills Hardware and Building Supply. We share offices with Freedom Designs and Marketing for all your graphic needs. Our company website is www.mylandpro.com. Just a program note, our time has been switched at the first of the year. Dr. Barbie Ask the Doctor show will follow this show and will air at 10 a.m. just after this show. Our guest today is Jib Davidson. Welcome, Jib.
Hello. How are y'all?
From Gainesville, Florida, right?
Yes, sir. Gainesville, Florida.
How's the weather down there?
Well, the weather is absolutely gorgeous. It's a beautiful 80-degree day and white, fluffy clouds and a beautiful blue sky. Couldn't ask for better.
Is that where you grew up?
No, sir. I actually grew up in Sarasota, Florida. I came up here to go to forestry school with my girlfriend. She also is a forester.
Really?
Ended up getting married, have kids, and our first job was right here in Gainesville, so we never left.
Wow, and all your kids are foresters too, right?
No, they're not.
Okay.
One works for what we call the Mouse, Disney World.
Yeah, I know about the Mouse.
Yeah, he's a financial analyst in the gift department. We learned a lot about Disney World through him.
I bet.
And the other one is got married last fall to a Canadian, and we got our first granddaughter on the way. So
good for
excited.
You. Congratulations. So
we all excited. I thought you had to go to Walmart to get one, but apparently not.
No, it's Kmart, but they went out of business.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
So you're a proud owner of Columbia Timber Company.
Yes, sir.
And you're also a broker owner of United Country Franchise like us in auctions.
Yes, sir. Coincidentally, we are. We do land sales. We probably spend a little more time in land procurement for people than we do land sales. People like us because not only can we do the land procurement, but we can also assist them with the land management, too.
Wow. What percentage of your business is that?
The procurement side or the management side?
Well, both. Kind of break it down.
The procurement side is... It's a pretty good share, but we also supply biomass to a local biomass mill, energy-producing mill, and we also have a timber procurement business. So that actually supplies probably about 60 or 70% of our revenue.
Gotcha.
We work more on a kind of a specialty basis with buying real estate for people.
Interesting. So you're a certified forester with the Society of American Foresters. You're currently a graduate student enrolled in the Albany University School of Forestry and Wildlife Sciences and Forestry Finance and Investment Certification Program. What's that all about?
That's a mouthful to say all
that.
That
is.
Auburn has a graduate program for people interested in timber investment analysis. I've always been interested in timber investment analysis and farm investment analysis, too. We do both.
Goes hand in hand.
So this is just kind of a way of sharpening my skills, sharpening my saw. I want to see what they have to say about timberland investment. So it's fun, and you learn a little bit. I'm surprised how much I already knew. I guess it kind of reinforces that. But there's always room for new ideas, new concepts, and so that's the idea of being in the Auburn Graduate School program.
You know, when I went to school, we had to take a test about what you're supposed to do when you grow up. And forestry was what I was supposed to do. But when I was growing up, I didn't know what a forester was. And I thought it was just something men done. So I didn't pursue it. And now that I'm older, much older, and have a real estate license, I wish that I would have. And I've tried to get my niece to do it. But, and I know this is very basic, but what is a forester?
Well, it's almost like asking what is an engineer, whether it's electrical engineers, chemical engineers, civil engineers. And then, of course, with foresters, there's urban foresters and then foresters that work for utilities in a right-of-way. My particular area of expertise, and we kind of broke it down into two areas, are people that like to buy land, hold land, We manage it for those people. We're growing a crop. We're farmers, so they get all the benefits of being a farmer while they're growing their trees, growing their timber, to produce, which we sell to mills, to produce products that you and I use every day.
Wow. I see here Lou has a list of all of your education, and it's like pages. How long did it take you to do all this?
Well, the fun thing about forestry, being a forester, you have to like learning. If you don't like learning, if you don't go to school, if you don't continue with your education, you kind of dead in the water. The way we practice forestry today really has no relationship to the way we did it back in 1980, really when I first got started with mm-hmm. Georgia Pacific. So you have to stay on top of things, and that's why the education continues.
Yeah, I've went to school since 1982 myself. Well, I graduated in 82, so, and I never quit. I've enjoyed learning, and that's how I finally got into real estate. And I wanted something challenging and interesting and fun, and I've really enjoyed it. And I really wish that I had went towards forestry. If I had understood more what it was, I would have pursued it. And I've tried to get my niece to do it, and she was like, "Do you have to get your hands dirty?" And I was like, "Never mind."
Well, you really don't, not on the forestry end of it, because everything I do is really kind of analytical. You know, I have people who work for me. They're the ones that kind of get their hands dirty, if you will. Real happy with them. They do a good job. But I couldn't do their job. I mean, I don't even know how to do it, but I don't need to know how either. When we're looking for property, you know, we're looking for soils, we're looking for mills, we're looking for things that enhance the investment criteria of a piece of property.
Okay.
I noticed that you're going to be a featured speaker of an upcoming University of Florida School of Forestry Resource and Conservation for the Florida Society of American Foresters Spring Symposium. I think it's 40-some years now, on April 30th. The topic's going to be when to harvest, economic drivers of your pine stand rotation. Tell me about that.
Well, that's a classic example of what's changed from when I went to forestry school and the way I first went to forestry, or when I first started practicing forestry, and how we do it now. So every year, that's not true, for 2 years in a row, and then we skip a year, the School of Forest Resources and Conservation at the University of Florida has this spring symposium for foresters and landowners in conjunction with the Society of American Foresters. And I'm going to be speaking on investment drivers. So what is an investment driver? It's kind of an individual thing to some degree, but the key that sometimes we miss is how important growth is. Growth and forestry investments are what it's all about. So the main driver is the growth of the tree itself. Because if the tree puts on 8 tons per acre per year, you know what you get every year? 8 tons. And the following year, 8 more tons. So that's an investment driver, the growth of the tree. You can be flatlined in the price you get for your timber, but that price continues to go up because you multiply price times quantity. So if the quantity goes up, your investment goes up, even if the price stays flat. So and price is another investment driver, but about 3/4 of the investment driver is really the growth. The other quarter might be land appreciation coupled with timber price appreciation. It's really the smallest of the components. So that's the first focus is on investment drivers. And then the second focus is, when do we harvest? How do we know it's ready to harvest? So I'm doing a little presentation on that growth. The growth always starts out where it increases at an increasing rate. Then it hits a peak. And then growth will continue to increase, but it increases at a decreasing rate. Where's that point of inflection? That's what you want to figure out in your timberland management, if that makes any sense to you.
Totally. So you're licensed, are you practicing in Florida, Georgia, and Alabama?
Those are our three dominant states, sometimes South Carolina. But our focus is in the south half of Georgia and the southeastern kind of quadrant of Alabama and, of course, North Florida.
What's a typical customer?
Really, that's an interesting question, and we keep trying to figure that out. We have some people And you know this, Lou, from your experience in dealing with land. We have some people, they're all about portfolio investment. It's all about maximizing rate of return. It's all about income generating. It's all about how can we get our maximum yield out of this thing we call land. Next guy comes along. Well, he's actually all about recreation. He wants to build a little cabin on his place maybe, or he wants a place to run his four-wheelers, or he's a photographer, or he's a hunter, and he wants to kill a big buck, or maybe he's into quail hunting. So maybe recreation is that person's objective. Next guy comes along, and he's interested in ecology. He's interested in restoration. He wants to be able to create a ecological place for him and for his family. And the next guy comes along, and he's interested in wealth transfer. It turns out timber is a great place to put a lot of money and then transfer it to the next generation. A lot of good tax benefits if you qualify. So it's kind of a whole group of different people. Developers, that's another one of our good customers. Now, developers want transitional property. They're going to want property right next to a growing community, right outside of Jacksonville or right outside of Savannah or wherever the case may be. So that's it's kind of where the individual is coming from, and our job, of course, is to figure that out and provide them the land that they want.
On your website, you talk about specialties, timber recreational land management specialist, commercial site selection in rural areas, timber investments, timber taxation, which I'd like to get into in more detail, land acquisition and marketing, land development and staging, expert witness, obviously, for legal cases, forest operations, which is reforestation and logging, biomass analysis, I'd like to get into that a little bit, too, and forestry certification. Of course, you do environmental, including wetland delineations and restoration, phase one environmental audits, and threatened and endangered species analysis. That's something that I'd like to talk about in the show today, too. Plus invasive species removal. We're talking about like powder post beetles and some of your pines. Is that in that category?
Well, it's more of species that don't belong on the site. They were probably brought in. A real problem in southeastern United States right now, Georgia. Georgia, of course, is famous for its kudzu.
We love kudzu.
What's that?
We love kudzu. We got it here, too.
Yeah, well,
get you some goats.
So kudzu is a real problem trying to get rid of it. You've seen those fields that are just totally overgrown with kudzu. Then they kill the trees. They kill the understory. There's no habitat for wildlife. It's a horrible plant. It's invasive. It's exotic and invasive. Not all exotics are invasive, but if you have both of them, the exotic and invasive, well, we got to do what we can to get rid of it.
And what's your solution?
All depends on the site and all depends on the plant. Primarily, our primary tool is herbicide.
Okay.
You brought up kudzu, so I'll just focus on that
for a
moment.
Yeah, sure.
That's probably a three-year process to really get rid of it.
Wow.
We go in with and spray it. We may do that with a helicopter if there's enough acres and it's bad enough. We may go in with backpack sprayers and individually treat. But the kudzu will come back, unfortunately. I mean, it's just such a resilient plant.
Right.
So we'll have to come back and we'll respray it. But we may be 80% successful the first year or 70% successful. But the problem is that 20 or 30% left over. And we'll come back and do it again the next year. And now we're probably going to have 10% residual kudzu. Then the third year, we should have it under control. Should be gone by the third year.
Are you having to pull the vines down?
No, we don't care.
They just kind of disintegrate on their own.
And if you got a little bit of kudzu in your backyard and it's going up the tree, sure.
Yeah. And so goats don't work? I always tell people get goats.
They do work, actually. We say that kind of tongue-in-cheek, a little bit of humor, but goats will actually work if you're into animal husbandry. We've seen that work before, but it doesn't do it. The problem with goats is they don't get the rootstock, and that's what you got to work on. And unfortunately, herbicides is the best defense that I know of with kudzu, as well as cogan grass, and there's a whole host of stuff. Big, long list of exotic and invasive species.
I love the goats. That's what I always tell clients, and, go to the stockyard, get you the $5, $10 goat, and get you some fencing and some solar panels and, you know, map out stuff, leave them there till they get that patch and move on to the next. Because they really do eat everything. This is Jib Davidson, our guest today. This is Let's Talk Land. Let's talk about land acquisition and marketing. How does that work for your organization?
Well, once we got to find out what the buyer's objectives are. So let's just assume that investment is part of it. They want to grow timber and they want to make money out of it. So what are the first two fundamental things we do? And exactly how we go about searching it is another thing. But what we look at is the mill locations. We got to know what kind of mills there are and where are they and how far away they are. Your timber is priced not based on a particular standard, one particular number, but it's based on how far you are from the mill. If you're within 40 miles of a mill, 45 miles from the mill, it's a minimum haul, so it's all the same. But you want to have at least two or three or four mills within your sphere of radius of your property. So far as I know, we've got the single largest database of mills for the southeastern United States.
Wow.
We have every mill located. We know what kind of mill it is. We know where they are. When you go to acquire a piece of property, we'll put a little dot using our mapping program, our mapping software, and we'll stick a wherever the location is, and we'll put in a 40-mile radius, and then we do a 100-mile radius. 40-mile radius because that's the minimum haul. We want to know where are the mills within the minimum haul, and then we want to know where are the mills that are possible usage within a 100-mile radius. So we list the pulp mills, we list the sawmills, we list the pole mills, all that sort of thing. Because if you're growing a timber crop and you don't know where your timber is going to go, you probably have a problem.
Right.
So the first thing is a mill analysis. If you have a piece of property but there's only one mill within 40 miles, what happens if that mill goes out of business? Where are you? So we do the mill analysis is what kind of timber do they buy, because that also dictates how we're going to manage it, and what's the probability that that mill is going to be there in 10 years. Is it a big company, good holding, do they make a good product, or is it going to be outmodeled? We've had Georgia-Pacific close a lot of plywood mills really in the last 10 years because plywood is just not the same building material it used to be. So now we got to change our management a little bit. We no longer manage for ply logs in those basins, and we switch to some other product, and we pay attention to mills. The second thing we look at is soils. We're all about the soil. Lou, you know this from your land dealings and farmland that you've dealt with. If you've got lousy soils, you're going to get lousy growth. There's just not much more to say about that. Now, if you've got good soils, you're going to get good growth. Earlier I talked about 8 tons per acre per year. That comes from good soil.
Okay.
If you got lousy soils, you might get half that. You get 3 tons per acre per year growth. So which would you rather have?
I think I like the 8 better.
Yeah, the 8's better. We can actually do better than 8 on really good soils. But, Lou, were you at the RLI conference? Yeah, you were at the RLI conference, weren't you, out of New Mexico?
Yes, sir, I was.
Do you remember one of the economists made a statement, I think, out there, and he said that the spread in price between good quality soil and poor quality soil is not that great.
I remember that.
And he's absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what's the price difference? For whatever reason, land is not priced based on soil's productivity.
No, we don't do that here.
They don't do it in Alabama. They don't do it in Georgia. They don't do it in Florida. And it's just go, wow.
But it's coming. It's coming. The technology, some of the people we've had on the show and stuff that's going on, I don't want to take up your time, but the technology is getting ready to explode. In all aspects of land and land production. I don't know. I won't live to see all of it, but it's getting exciting.
You are right. The technology is changing. I totally agree.
I know your business and my business has changed. I'm sure yours has.
So, when we use our mapping software and we're looking at satellite imagery, We do both wetlands as well as, infrared for wetlands as well right. as color satellite imagery. We look at the neighborhood. We did a lot of factors that go into that site selection.
What websites do you use for your mapping and stuff? Just curious.
Our mapping program, in fact, we learned about this mapping program attending a United Country annual meeting called MapRight.
Yeah, that's who we use. Yeah, Steve, they just revamped it last week.
They did.
Incredible. And they got some new stuff coming I can't tell you about right now.
Actually, I sat down with them, and we at one of the conferences and went through kind of a tutorial. But we use MapRight as our basic mapping program.
Right.
We also use GIS technology.
Mm-hmm.
The GIS technology is for larger tracks. It allows us to put different layers. So we have like a small GIS department, so to speak.
Okay.
And that's for shape files. That allows us to put stands on it, management units on it. That allows us to manage someone's property. And we do it graphically through these maps. And MapRight can't do that. Doesn't have that power if you're managing a 3,000-acre property,
sure.
for example.
Big file.
Yeah, so MapRight is good for small tracks, but you very quickly reach its limitations, and we switch over to GIS if we need to.
Gotcha. Greasy, got something?
Well, I was just sitting here. I'm learning a lot. This is very interesting to me, but I'm learning more than I don't know the questions to ask.
Teresa's our student.
Yeah, I am. I've only been selling real estate now for about 8 months, so I'm very new.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm very new, and I'm learning. So you were talking about soils. Is that something that you can market or not?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. If we're going to sell a piece of property for someone or list a piece of property for them, that's one of the first things we do is we're going to do soils if you're going to buy it or if you're going to sell it.
So you bring in a soil scientist?
Well, we do that too, actually. Interesting you should ask that. I can do a certain amount. I have my limitations in soils because I'm not a soil scientist. I'm a forester. But we have a soil scientist who is also a forester. He's first and foremost a soil scientist, and then he's a forester. So we'll actually bring him in. His name is Pete Clito, and he actually will do a complete soil analysis of any piece of property that we buy for someone. And then we take his data, and we transfer that into something called the CRIF soil groups. I don't want to get too complicated, but that allows us to tell us what kind of species we're going to plant. It allows us to match the right species to the right site, because you'd be amazed how many people will plant a particular species because their neighbor down the road did. You know, so-and-so did it that way, I'm going to do it that way.
Right.
You know, or my daddy did it that way, I'm going to do it that way.
Are there specific varieties of trees that will affect the quality of the soil?
No, the quality of the soils affect the way the tree will grow.
Okay.
What you want to do is make sure you match the right species to the right soil type.
So you could have more than one species, say, in a 50-acre plot or a 100-acre or 200-acre plot. It could be more than one species?
Well, probably will keep the same species on a small piece like that on 40 acres or 80 acres or something.
Because your soils will change.
Yeah, but, yeah, you're right. So if the soil changes, though, we may put one species on the south side. And
that's what I'm saying,
We may put a different species on the north side.
Exactly.
The most common species for those who are interested in timberland investment in the southeast is loblolly.
Right.
Loblolly, they've done a tremendous amount of genetics on, and there's two premier nurseries right now that really shine with loblolly. And we've done a lot of work with ArborGen, one of those premier nurseries.
What's it called?
ArborGen, ArborGen, I think, ArborGen.
Where are they out of?
Well, they've got a bunch of nurseries scattered all over.
I gotcha.
And I'd have to look them up.
No,
in
that's
home
fine.
Offices. I think it's in South Carolina.
Okay.
Is their home office? I'm not sure. You need to verify that.
Okay.
So I have a client who just listed some land with us, and he's got loblolly pine on it. And he inherited this land from a member of his family. So he doesn't know anything about it. The loblolly was planted, he said, around 15 to 18 years ago. So is there something he needs to be doing that I need to advise him?
Absolutely. The first thing you want to do, mill analysis.
Okay.
So what are the mills within his area, within 40 miles, within 100 miles? So you need to find out whether you're growing pulpwood for a pulp mill,
mm-hmm.
or are you growing chip and saw that's half pulp and half saw timber?
Mm-hmm.
Are you growing poles? Who's paying the most, and where are those mills located relative to his property?
Oh, okay.
That's going to dictate whether or not you thin. That's going to dictate whether or not you fertilize. Loblolly is very sensitive to cultural treatment, so it responds really, really well to things like fertilization and thinning. So that's a good tree to deal with. But you want to be able to take a look at those and see where he is. We also, when we get into a site like that, we may do a foliar analysis and a soil analysis. We actually take samples out of the top. You want to be at the top of the tree, get the branches out of there, send it into the lab, have them crunch it, and come back with a tree nutrition report.
Is that like a hair analysis?
A foliar, F-O-L. IAR, foliar analysis. Like,
yeah.
A hair analysis, I guess.
Yeah.
But in my case, I'm going bald, so like there's
trees have hair. It. Come on, Teresa, didn't you know that?
Well,
tree nutrition. I never even thought about tree nutrition, but I guess
if
makes
you want
sense.
The 8 and 10 tons per acre per year, you're very involved with tree nutrition, and
wow.
You're monitoring that all the time.
This is a lot of good stuff. This is very interesting.
But the key to this is also have a good local forester, right? I mean, that's your key.
Well, I like to think so, but I'm very prejudiced when I say
well,
that.
Well, I mean, come on.
But I know what a forester can do for someone, and I like to think we're worth our weight in gold.
I would say you are.
And I remind my wife of that, too.
Yeah, well.
So you were talking about pole mills. Like, I guess that's for smaller trees?
Well, for medium and larger trees.
Okay.
Those big telephone poles, barnyard poles.
Oh.
They got to come from somewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, duh. You got toothpicks, too, you know? I mean, those are small little teeny trees.
Little teeny trees.
Yeah, those little Japanese
okay.
guys.
Yeah.
Those little, right?
Well, toothpicks got to come from somewhere.
Yeah.
That's a fact.
Because if you think about the products that these mills make, you know, the people that count these kinds of things will tell you that forestry touches everyone's life in this country 5 times the first hour they are awake.
How's that?
Well, certainly don't want to be getting personal here, but did either one of you brush your teeth this morning?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, kind of an important product. And I don't know if the percentage is exactly correct. I'm going off the top of my head, but I'm thinking about 80 to 85% of the toothpaste you use is a pine pulp. Turns out that the cleaning part of toothpaste, the mint and all that good stuff, the things that do the polishing, if you put that on top of your brush, that material would soak into the brush. And the American consumer, they just can't stand that. You've got to have your toothpaste on top of the bristles. And so the pulp is what keeps the toothpaste on top of the bristles.
Yeah, the fibers.
On top of the fibers. And by the way, the fibers were probably made from pulp themselves. And the handle was, if you think it was plastic, it was probably made from pulp. And the toothpaste that you used this morning probably came in a cardboard box. And the cardboard box probably came packaged with cellophane wrap, you know, came from cellulose. And it was probably sent to whatever store you purchased it from in a larger cardboard box that came from pine trees. And the cardboard boxes were probably all put on a wooden pallet before they were put on the truck and shipped to you. So that's how often forestry touched your life, just to brush your teeth.
That is so good, because I had a customer not too long ago, and it was, I didn't have any idea how to respond to him. I had some land that I told him that had good timber value. He said, oh, that's not going to be a thing in a few years. Everything's going to steel, and timber's going to be a thing of the past. And I was like, okay.
No. Ask him if he drove a car in the last 10 years. Because inside that car is oil filters, fuel filters, gas filters, and what is inside the casing of those filters but some sort of pulp material. What he thought was plastics in his dashboard,
mm-hmm.
and the interior of his car is more than likely a pulp product. People confuse pulp with plastic a lot.
Well, I know.
Certainly not trying to get, you know, personal here, but one of my favorite products I like to remind people is, you know, toilet paper. I think we like toilet paper.
We do.
It serves a nice utility. And by the way, that toilet paper is all rolled onto a cardboard tube.
Thank God it's not metal.
And that toilet paper all came in a cellophane wrapped or cellulose wrapped package, which came in a cardboard box, which was shipped on a wooden pallet.
Well, you know, you might be a landman or a landlady if you got five rolls of toilet paper in the trunk of your car. So we're talking with Jib Davidson today. This is Let's Talk Land.
Jib, we were talking about the gentleman that was telling me that wood is going to be replaced by metal, and there's not going to be any place for it. And you and I were talking about that a little bit. Could you elaborate more on the movement towards lumber and wood as opposed to metal?
Sure. I would say exactly the opposite. There is a huge movement right now with structured panels, structured laminated lumber, and that's creating beams that hold a tremendous amount of stress. Now, you very quickly get to where you need a structural engineer and get outside of my realm of expertise, but putting together these structural panels and structural engineering products, tremendous amount of potential. Those things are now three, four, five stories straight up. And so I would argue that really wood is taking the place of metal in particular because a timber investment or owning timberland or any even recreational land is a green investment. It's eco-friendly. It is sustainable, very sustainable, and it meets all the criteria that people are looking for in a renewable, sustainable kind of resource. And that's what wood gives you.
Yeah, and I'm sure that is huge, especially with the people that are worried and concerned about our environment and things that do not deteriorate.
Well, that's exactly true. I mean, how more sustainable can you get than forestry? It's renewable, and while you're growing, and this is kind of fun, your trees automatically are doing carbon sequestration. And so how cool is that? You're contributing to defeating, if you believe in greenhouse gases and global warming, if you do believe that that exists, because I guess that's still controversial, I don't know. But it's a great investment to combat that.
Right.
So if you believe in it, then perfect. You've got a great investment. If you don't believe in it, well, it doesn't matter because you're doing it anyway.
Well, that gives me something to go back with now and maybe help me to sell timber land because that I really didn't know where to go when the guy started coming at me with the metal thing. And I went home and asked my husband because he builds houses, and he said, that's crazy. That's not happening.
Well, your husband's, I think, spot on. I don't know who the guy is, but he needs to do a little more reading.
Hey, Jib, I got a question for you. Are there any federal or state or local tax incentives for forestry investments?
There is a lot of federal, state, and local tax incentives. Obviously, on a national radio program like this, it's difficult to focus on the local ones.
Right.
And it's even... state are kind of hard, but if you talk at the federal level, if you buy a piece of timberland and you start growing trees, you don't have to start growing trees. You can buy a 10-year-old stand or you can buy a 15-year-old stand, and if you buy a 10-year-old stand, well, you're two-thirds of the way to when you're going to harvest it anyway.
Right.
So it kind of works like bonds. You don't have to have a 20-year-old bond. You can sell it at any time, and the same thing with timberland. However, that income, as long as you hold it for 1 year and 1 day, is all capital gains income. So it's taxed at the lowest possible tax rate. And in fact, if you buy a 10-year-old stand, you actually calculate what was the value of that land when you bought it. And you value the 10-year-old stand, and then you subtract that from the sale proceeds volume, and then that difference is taxed at capital gains, not the whole thing. I know some timberland owners, I find out after the fact, reported the entire sales as capital gains income rather than adjusting for their basis.
Right.
Basis is part
key.
Of any investment.
Sure.
Ongoing management expenses are fully deductible against ordinary income.
Okay.
Reforestation is fully expensed up to $10,000 per year However, that's per qualified timber property.
How do you qualify it?
Well, the IRS, Congress never said how we're going to qualify that.
Okay.
And when, as you well know, legislation, all tax legislation starts in the House Ways and Means Committee, and then it gets passed by both houses, and then goes to the Department of Revenue, who then figures it out, and they do revenue rulings, and then they send it to the IRS for enforcement, and there's letters of ruling and all that good stuff. No one's defined that.
Interesting.
So what is a qualified timber property? So as a certified forester, we've got some parameters. And what we try to do is put, if you have, say, $50,000 you wanted to spend in reforestation in any one tax year, we come up with five qualified timber properties. And maybe we're going to change species, we're going to change soils, we're going to change locations, we're going to change planting density, we're going to make sure that it's not consistent. And then you can deduct the entire $50,000 instead of being limited to the $10,000.
Hmm.
So there are things we can do to really minimize taxes. Aside from the fact that you are in the business, so all business expenses are fully deductible, which includes every trip you make to your property.
Right.
That's fully deductible. Keep a log. If you buy something, the tests that we like to tell people about are ordinary and necessary.
Okay.
So do other timberland owners ordinarily deduct this expense? And is it necessary for you to have this deduction to maintain your trees?
Okay.
So, you know, people will buy a farm tractor. Well, you need to plow fire lines. You need to keep your place mowed. Or you can contract that out, or we can do that service for you. We have the equipment. So there's a lot of flexibility and parameters in there that people can use tax-wise. And, of course, I said earlier, you can also use it for to pass property on to the next generation. There's something called the family farm. There's a tax division where you can have the thing valued at its ability to grow timber, pass that on to the next generation at a very, very low basis. And as long as, you know, there's a string attached to that, because there's like always strings attached.
Of course.
But that thing's, if you keep it for 1 year and one, I'm sorry, for 10 years in one day, then you can pass on a lot of money very cheap. So you've got a lot of wealth redistribution.
And I guess you see 1031s involved in this too, right?
Absolutely.
Totally.
We do a lot of 1031s. We have people who sell apartment complexes, and they're tired of the hassle of management because it still qualifies. 1031's
right.
Still there.
Yep.
You know, for real property, personal property, I think, is gone.
That's true.
But real for real, and so you sell your apartment complex or your shopping center, and we do a tax re-exchange for a large tract of timberland. And perfect. As long as you buy a more expensive piece of property, you pay zero taxes. Now, that's a deferment.
Right.
Are you familiar with these qualified properties now?
Yes. Yep. Yeah, I actually teach that in my Land 101 class. Just a little bit. We have a, you know, full class on the 1031, a 16-hour course through the Realtors Land Institute. But, yeah, I touch on it.
That actually got my appetite whetted, if you will, for the Realtors Land Institute, because United Country told me that the Realtors Land Institute was teaching a 1031 class. This was years ago, like 10 years ago or
right.
something. And I thought, well, you know, I should probably take that class. We were talking about education earlier. I
sure.
That would be pretty good. And I spent 2 days learning about 1031.
Yeah, 1031, 1032, 1028. There's a lot
yeah.
of different ones. Of course, that changed
excellent
with
class.
The new tax laws, but got rid of the personal stuff, the jets and the jewelry and the garbage that people were using. So
yeah,
kind of cleaned it up.
But still, if you have the basis, you can move on with that and sharpen the saw, so to speak.
And this doesn't have to be a planted forest. This can be natural growth forest too, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Real for real. That's
yep.
the parameter.
Yeah.
And nobody says what kind of real it's got to be, which is kind of interesting.
Okay, I have a question. And remember, I'm new. What's the difference in forest certification and the qualified that we were just talking about? Is there a difference, or is it the same thing?
Big big difference.
Okay.
So for a certification, and there are four primary certifications that are used in North America. Go to Europe, they use a different set, and there's actually dozens and dozens of certifying agencies. But the four big ones that are used in the southeastern United States is where you, the landowner, pledge to maintain your property based on that certification.
Okay.
And so it's going to say, well, and some of the things are like really common sense. So if we're going to change the oil in a piece of logging equipment or a tractor, shall we open, should we dig a hole and bury the oil in the ground? Or should we collect it and dispose of it like it should be disposed of?
Hope so.
So if you are certified for it, you are pledging that you will not dump your oil on the ground.
Right.
So that's kind of what's going on there. In general, and this isn't always true, but in general, in most of the southeastern United States, forest certification does not increase the value of your timber. The mills don't pay anything extra for certified timber. Like I said, that's not. There are pockets where that is not a true statement.
Okay.
But it is a process because it's expensive. Depending on which one you choose, it's expensive to go through that process.
What would be a typical fee just to just range or stuff? Just to...
Well, so it depends on your program. There's the tree farm program put out by the American Forest Institute. And they, that's no charge. We do that for free.
Okay.
We volunteer our time to a volunteer organization, and that's the easiest certification with the least amount of restrictions. But you've seen those green and white American tree farmer signs, probably?
Absolutely.
That's what we're talking about.
Okay.
So that one is free. That's cool. There's no problem. But then you can get into SFI, Sustainable Forestry Initiative. And now you're talking about a fairly high-level certification. That's going to run you, you know, at minimum $20,000 to get certified on that. You got to have a lot of work done, and you got to have certain contracts in place. And so the standards are much higher. But again, there's a lot more.
And that would probably be for larger acreage tracts as opposed to the small, you know, 20, 30, 40-acre tract.
Yeah, your 20, 30, 40-acre tracts is not going to do that.
Right.
They're not going to spend that kind of money.
Sure.
If they're going to be certified,
at
it's
all.
Probably going to be a tree farm program.
Okay.
But I think certification is great, but it's just not economical for medium and smaller landowners.
Is that something,
other than the tree farm.
Is that something a typical certified forester can do, provide that service? Is that
yes,
taken
absolutely.
Out? Okay.
Absolutely.
Or a state forester? State forester could do it?
Some state foresters do it. Some states have their own program. For example, Florida has a stewardship program. And, of course, they obviously want you to use their state certification program.
Right.
Because they're state foresters, and they're supposed to take on the state's position on stuff. And so you can do a state certification. So that may be free for a smaller track, or you may need a forester who's going to charge to do all the work that's required because, you know, think government, a lot of paperwork that most people don't need, but it's part of the plan.
You got it.
By the same token, there is sometimes cost sharing where the state will pay a private forester to help.
Hmm. Let's move into a different subject if we can. In your website, you talk about a TIP, T-I-P, program that you guys have developed, you and Mr. Norman. What's that about? What's the acronym?
Timber Investment Program. TIP stands for Timber Investment Program.
Is this something you guys have created for the market?
This is something we've created.
Okay.
It is, when I graduated from forestry school at the University of Florida, of course, they teach you all about how to grow trees. They don't really teach you very much on investment analysis side of things. University of Georgia now has an outstanding master's program for timberland investment. And, of course, Auburn has this master's certificate that I'm enrolled in for that sort of thing. Those are really the only two sources. So far as I can tell, University of Georgia does really an excellent job with their master's of timber investment program. But years ago, because I was trying to understand this, I have a second bachelor's degree in finance and real estate. So I've taken those finance principles, applied them towards timber, and created the Timber Investment Program, or the TIP. And basically, we look at each management unit as a separate entity. We look at the cost of acquisition. We look at an investor's hurdle rate. If we have an investor that's interested in efficient frontiers are a big deal for investment counselors. We incorporate all of those things into the analysis. And that includes a reversion, that includes growing the timber, that includes all the costs of reforestation. And we put that into this one program, and it really works out really well, and that's what the Timber Investment Program is. Very unique to our firm. I'm sure there's others that have developed something like that. But it'll show you your rate of return, your cash flows. It's going to show you how much you're going to spend in 3 years from now or 7 years from now and what your revenue is going to be. We do everything in real dollars. We don't use nominal dollars.
Wow.
So that's your timber investment program.
Gotcha. So just another question in some of my research Teresa and I was doing. DNA and using isotopes, and also, timber's grown all over grown all over the world. And my understanding is there's more standing trees in the world today than there was 100 years ago. I don't know if that's true. But, there's, 20 years ago, the Japanese were buying a lot of timber, and they were actually cutting it here in America and putting it on a ship. And by the time it got to Japan, it was already honed and turned into wood and turned into product and so on. And is this identifying a tree stand, is that important in terms of, theft or fraud or?
Well, there is theft and fraud, as there would be in any business. I don't think there's any business that is immune to that. We've had people come into our office and say, I want to sell my timber. And once we investigate it, we find out they don't even own the timber.
I love it.
it's true.
Yeah. No, we have that here, too.
He was fired from his job, and his boss owned some timberland, so he was going to get back at his boss by selling his boss's timberland, and he was going to keep the money.
True revenge.
True revenge. We're talking about something that just rarely happens.
I understand.
Very, very, very rare. But we've been involved in a couple of those things over the decades. It's there, but it's not common.
Yeah, but I was looking at barcoding and Genesis and fingerprinting, which country the timber comes from, region, population, polygraphy of species. So that's not really that important, right?
No. The mills, your medium-sized and large mills, we send a lot of timber, for example, to a Georgia-Pacific mill here in North Florida, and they photograph every load that crosses their scales. They photograph the front, the sides, and the back. They know whose truck it is. They know where that wood came from, so there's very strict protocols in dealing with wood transportation systems.
Yeah, my forester does that too. He's got the cameras out there on site.
And we put cameras on site, and anybody's welcome to put cameras on site on anything we do, and if they should not feel squeamish about that at all. We encourage it. Hey, if you want to put cameras out there, please have at it. So that's there for wood security. There's also a ticket system that we'll use. We keep very close track. We reconcile our crews. Our crews are paid based on volume and production. So if they want to get paid extra, they know that they've got to sort their wood exactly so. We're real strict on wood sorting, getting the right wood to the right mill, because that's the landowner's bread and butter.
Sure.
And they're depending on us to do it. So we want to make sure we do it in as good of a job as we can.
Is there any such thing as a small timber harvest? I mean, there's different levers of timber companies. I mean, you got the guy that's got the 1 acre lot and he wants 10 trees cut, and then you got the person that's got the 5 acre lot and, wants the trees cut and so on.
Yeah, unfortunately, the point you raise is an important point to understand. We get calls literally every week from someone. someone that's got three trees in their backyard.
I love it.
And what we know instantly where we are on the pecking order on their phone calls.
Right.
Because if we're like the first person they call, they want to sell their trees.
Sure.
If we're like the fifth or sixth person they've called, they'll give them away. And we tell them that if you want three trees cut in your backyard, that's what a tree surgeon does.
Right.
Of course, they'll respond, well, that costs money.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Well,
On the other hand, we cannot move $750,000 or $1 million worth of harvesting equipment onto somebody's property for three trees.
Yeah, most of my foresters say it has to be a minimum of 18 loads to make it worthwhile.
18 loads is a good number. That really is. 20 loads would even be a better number.
Right.
And if you're looking at tonnage, figure 25 loads on a truck. So let's just say at 25 tons per load, 20 loads, you're looking at 500 tons. If the land has 75 tons per acre on it, you're looking at 6.5 acres.
Okay.
Now, what will typically happen, it's volume is the key, not acreage. Nine times out of 10, well, in fact, maybe 95 times out of 100, if you have 10 acres, unfortunately, we can't help you. It's just too small of a volume. It just is too much time, and our equipment is too expensive to move for those kinds of tracks. I really prefer 15 acres and above. But you asked earlier, what kind of mapping software do we use? Well, we use MapRite, and the first thing we do, we go to MapRite, we go look at it, we see, well, how does it look from a satellite image? And if it's got potential at 15 acres, we'll go out and look at it.
Right.
So it's really a volume is what we look for, not acres.
I had an experience just briefly, but the last track I saw, it's been a number of years ago, was the 39-acre track. Hills and hollows, off the road, definitely 100-year, I found out, old timber, but very, very healthy. Used to have two lumber yards that come by, owners, and they'd say, you got any land listings, timber listings this week or this month? And I'd say, well, there's a 40-acre track or there's a 50-acre track, looked pretty good when I listed it. And they'd go out and cruise it, and, you know, the old methods, just walk. And, of course, these guys couldn't read and write, but, boy, they knew the math.
That's right.
They come back and say, well, if you find a buyer for that, I tell them I'll give them $80,000 for the timber, which is in this case mine. And then I didn't own it at the time, but $90,000 was the other guy's comment. And the person I listed it for got into a cash crunch and he said, I got to get rid of this real quick. So, you know, and I always had buyers that said, if you got a good deal. And I knew it was $80,000, $90,000 worth of timber, and it was listed at $150,000, I think it was. Anyway, I did a deal with the owner, and I said, I'll buy it for $140,000. So I called the bank up, and the bank said, we'll give you 60% of the tax value on it, which was $40,000. And I knew it was $80,000, $90,000, so I knew it was $100,000 that I needed to get for the timber. So I called my forester up, and I said, how about getting out here and cruising this thing, and let's do an auction, which he did. And, of course, both of them showed up, plus five other bids. And I ended up getting $128,764.23 for the same timber that these two guys had offered $80,000 and $90,000. And the guy that offered $80,000 is the one that ended up paying $128,000 6 months later. For the public out there, what's the best method to sell your timber?
It's like anything else. It's like when you, for whatever reason, we got a lot of friends that are dentists. Now, I don't know how that happened. But the dentist, over dinner, over cocktails, they like to laugh because they say, well, when you come in the dentist office and the dentist tells you you've got a, that filling doesn't look too good, we got to redo it. Well, is the filling in fact bad, or is the dentist got to make his Porsche payment? And you learn a lot if you hang out with dentists about how not all dentists are exactly, and no offense to any dentist that may hear this, but.
Yeah, let's do a caveat there, a disclaimer.
Yeah. Well, you know, the lawyer bills you for 6 hours of contract preparation. Did he really spend 6 hours, or was it
while you were asleep, right?
So, unfortunately, every business has its flaws, if you will. You need to get with somebody that you trust.
Sure.
If you have somebody come out to your property and they just walk around it, what happens is the landowners sometimes bring this on themselves. They want, and we get into this ourselves. They bring you out, look at my timber, tell me, how much money do I have? Well, it's the first time you've seen the property. They put you in their four-wheeler or their truck, and they ride you through the road. They look out the window, and at the end of the ride, I want to know, how much have I got? And, of course, the landowner says, quite frankly, don't worry, I won't hold you to it. Oops.
Yeah.
You know you're going to be in trouble with that.
Right.
So what do you do? Do you say that, well, there's, in your case, do you say, well, there's $175,000 worth of timber out there? Oh, and then you go ahead and cut it, and there's ends up being $140,000. Or do you tell them that there's $75,000 or $80,000 out there, and then they get $140,000, and now they're happy? You can't give a high estimate because unless you're just planning on, again, flim-flamming the landowner. If you give them a real estimate, the only way to do that is an actual timber cruise.
Right.
And somebody who walks through it and gives you a price, you're probably lowballing them. But the landowner is going to say, I don't want to pay for a timber cruise. You just tell me what it is. You're a timber buyer. How much is that worth?
Right.
But don't charge me.
Yeah.
So, okay, you know, $70,000 is out there, which the timber buyer doesn't know. You do a timber cruise. You actually put in plots. You count trees. And you do it the way you're supposed to do it. And the best thing a landowner can do is hire a forester to cruise their timber.
Exactly.
And deal with honest.
And you're only talking maybe $300 or $400 or $500, depending on the stand. It's not huge money.
No. But it's like, Lou, how many times has somebody said, well, you come value my, you're a real estate man. How much is my land worth? And you say, get an appraisal done. We'll find out with a real appraisal because it's complicated. Oh, I don't want to spend the money on appraisal.
I just say it depends.
Yeah, you're in the real estate business. How much is the land worth?
Right.
So it's same thing.
Yeah.
No real difference. By the way, we only got a couple of minutes left, I think.
That's correct.
I wanted to say something real quick for both of you, both Teresa as well as yourself. Land staging. It's something that we have developed here at United Country, and I think you may have done a little bit of this yourself. If anybody's going to have an exit strategy and list their property, we oftentimes go in with a land staging program designed for them. What that means is we make the property nice looking for resale. It's kind of like we took the playbook right out of the home staging people, where they put in the couch and the nice painting and a couple plants and make the house look good.
Teresa, it'd look nice to have a couple couches out on a piece of wood.
I used to put
picnic tables.
Yeah. Well, you can actually do that.
No,
we've taken in mulchers and we've created walking trails and parking trails. We put in nice-looking board fences. We put in a nice gate, in that old, wore-out, rusted gate that's been there for years.
Right.
Maybe that needs to be replaced with a nice-looking gate. And how much does it cost to replace the gate and some fencing? $500?
Sure.
I don't know, but not that much. But you dress up the property, get it mowed, get it looking nice, maybe get some biomassing done where you get rid of the understory, create an environment that people want to buy. And as you well know, you tell me, Lou, what if we just increase the property? Another 20%
in
value?
Oh, easy.
Easy? Maybe 30?
Yeah, you know? Could. Yeah, absolutely.
So it's an investment that pays
if
you're a real estate agent, and you can talk somebody into spending a little money to clean up their property. And gosh knows if it's got trash on it, get the trash out of there.
Yeah.
We call those collectible piles.
Well,
you never know what you're going to find in one. But with 3 minutes left, give us real quickly some stuff to leave our listening audience with, and we'll let you do your commercial, and we'll finish this up.
Well, I'm going to say my commercial will be for the industry.
Yes, sir.
Timber is a great investment. It's a phenomenal way of controlling retirement funds or, you know, world funds or however you want to do it. However, make sure you focus on mills, know your mill locations, and go talk to the mill people because that's going to dictate how you manage it. And soils, good quality soils gives you good growth. So that would be the first thing I would say. Secondly, United Country, I'll do a little plug for United Country.
Please.
They got very good listing tools and some good ways of presenting property. Combine that with what we just talked about, land staging. And United Country can do a great job for you. So there's timber investment, there's recreational investment, there's transitional land, land right next to the growing community that may have houses on it in 10 years. You can plant trees that are temporary. Typically in the South, you get the lowest ad valorem property taxes in timberland than of any other form, so you want to get it in timber and keep it in timber.
How do they get in touch with you?
They can call us, 352-375-1473. That's 352-375-1473. They can email me, jib@columbiatimber.com. That's jib@columbiatimber.com. And we have a website that we're just kind of redoing. Unfortunately, it's not where we want to get it. www.columbiatimber.com. And, of course, they can go to United Country's national website. And they can find us in Gainesville, Florida.
Perfect. Thank you for joining us today. Let us know how you like the show. If you have any guests or topics you'd like to suggest, we'd appreciate them. All questions are welcome, and all of our guests may be emailed with your questions or concerns as well. This show is for the public and, most importantly, for the real estate agents who do not have a source for land education. All shows are downloaded on www.letstalkland.net. Is also on Podbeam, Spotify, Facebook, YouTube, and more. My email is lou@mylandpro.com. My cell phone number is 336-669-1405. Rodney, how do they get in touch with us at the station?
Well, they can tune us in every Saturday morning from 9 to 10. And also they can download the Simple Radio app and tune us in all over the world.
All over the world.
That's it.
And what kind of station is
WKTE? We're Beach and Oldies, nominated for 5 years in a row for Station of the Year.
Wow. Okay, Jeb, thank you so much. You've been a wonderful guest today. Thank you for being part of our show.
And Luke, Teresa, we look forward to seeing you in the future.
Absolutely.